Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
I came across the date 1619 as a high school student and have been obsessed with the erasure of that date. And I came across it accidentally. I didn't come across it in my high school curriculum, but I took a one semester Black Studies elective and became so angry that there was all this history no one ever thought we should know that when the class ended, I kept going back to the teacher and asking him to give me more books. And I would read a book and then ask for another. And one of the books that he put in my hand was a book called Before the Mayflower by Lerone Bennett. And the title speaks to the fact that, you know, the Mayflower lands in 1620. Every American child learns about the Mayflower, but the White Lion came in 1619 and none of us learned about that. So even as like a 16 or 17 year old, I understood the power of that erasure and that was intentional. So I've been thinking literally since I was in high school about that date and how that date kind of served as a metaphor for the way we have not wanted to deal with the institution of slavery.
Hey, everybody, you know that you're listening to This Moment because you got on your device, you looked us up, and you clicked on play, and for that, we're very grateful. And if you've listened to this to us before, you know that this is an ongoing conversation between Chef Marcus Samuelson and myself, Jason Diakite. You also know that Marcus is in Harlem on Malcolm X Boulevard, to be exact, and I'm on the island of Södermalm in Stockholm, the capital of Sweden. What you don't know, however, is who today's guest is. And I am so excited about today's episode. And that's probably why I'm drawing this intro out a little bit. Because today we are honored and so grateful to have investigative reporter for the New York Times, MacArthur Fellow, that's the Genius Grant Award winner, and Pulitzer Prize winner, creator of the 1619 Project, which exists both in magazine form and as a podcast series, Nicole Hannah-Jones. Welcome.
Yes. Welcome.
All right, Nicole, let me start by saying I looked you up on Wikipedia earlier today. I like to do that with guests. And the moment I started reading, I stopped midway through the first sentence. And it was one word in particular that threw me off. You're described as a controversial journalist. And that made me think, you know, and that's in the opening sentence. And that made me think, like, how can the structural defensiveness against reexamining, taking a more candid, truthful, broader, deeper perspective and trying to enrich the narrative of our history still be so strong today, 401 years later? Why do you think that is, Nicole?
Well, first, let me say, I don't think I'm considered a controversial journalist. But if you look at the Wikipedia page, there's an ongoing battle with people who don't appreciate me, who keep editing the page to make it appear that I'm controversial. I haven't checked it recently, and that must be a new addition because within the field and broadly, I'm not considered a controversial journalist. So interesting. But clearly, you know, there has been a lot of opposition to my work around the 1619 Project and really a rejection to centering slavery in the American narrative and the contributions of Black Americans. When you ask why, I mean, the entire reason the 1619 Project had to come into existence is because we have wanted to be in denial about how central and foundational slavery was to the founding of this country, to the country that we would eventually build. And then, of course, the legacy of slavery permeates so many aspects of our society. And to see that argued in the New York Times was disconcerting.
I just have to say that the 1619, it's the most incredible gift to Black and brown people all over the world. You know, the work of reestablishing, you know, rewriting or reconnecting our journey is so important, and people all over the world connect to it. So I just want to say this is the reason why I go to New York Times still daily, every day. And when I heard it, both me and Jason were just like, when is the next piece coming out? And we've been going back and forth. You know, I'm a chef, so maybe the farmer story is the one that I'm like, that's my dude. But the way you connect past and present, it's unbelievable. It's such an important piece of work. So thank you for that.
And I've been thinking so much about this kind of collective sensitivity and taking a more truthful look at our history. Because I live in Sweden, Nicole, and it's literally a different world from the United States. And no doubt racism exists here, as it does in all countries. The interesting thing about Sweden and what sets it aside from other European countries is that it sees itself as a colorblind country, to the point that in 2017, the word race was removed from the discrimination legislation. So race doesn't appear in the legal in the law of this land anymore, and data by race is no longer collected. And incredibly, this was done in the name of anti-racism. And so, you know, 1619 has been widely circulated in this country, and it really inspires me and a lot of people in comprehensively kind of rethinking Sweden's history as well. And I mean, Sweden was a small fish in the colonial era, but involved to some extent in the transatlantic slave trade. But most of the cotton imported to Sweden during the 1800s came from the American South. And Sweden was deeply affected by the outbreak of the Civil War because the cotton stopped coming in. It became way more expensive. But these pieces of our history are so seldom told, and few have reckoned with these parts of our past. I wanted to ask you, as someone who's really at the forefront of doing this in the United States, how do you think the collective guilt and shame play into this collective sensitivity about re-examining history?
So, you know, it's interesting what you say about Sweden, because I think that America's obsession with race is a double-edged sword, right? Like, we measure race everywhere, and we categorize on every government document. I mean, it's good because we can count things and measure things, but it also speaks to, you know, how obsessed we are with ensuring people stay in their place in the caste system. So I always go back and forth about which is the better system. And of course, when you don't categorize and you can't measure inequality, it becomes much harder to kind of assess the degree of racial inequality in a community or in a country. But most of the history, and I would say even now, the United States' obsession with cataloging race has not been to the benefit of Black Americans or to actually eradicate racial inequality. So I'm not sure which is a better system. Maybe somewhere in between. I think, though, that we want to... The idea of being colorblind one on its face is ridiculous. Right. No one is asking anyone not to notice the differences, both physically and historic differences. It's what do you do with that information? That's the problem. So the fact that we feel we have to ignore and be colorblind is a deficit mindset, because what it's saying is, I won't pay attention to this flaw, or I'm not going to pay attention to this thing that is different. When really it's like, what do you do with that information? Do you treat people differently? Do you erect an architecture that divides people based on that? And we can't really grapple with this history. And I think what makes the United States different is all the other colonial powers that took place in the transatlantic slave trade had existed for hundreds, if not thousands of years before they engaged in slavery. They were not defined by slavery. The United States comes into being as a slaveocracy. You can't simply say, oh, that was a bad period of time, but look at everything else we did before. Everything about our story is linked to slavery. But also, we were the only one of those countries founded on the ideas of universal rights, that all men are created equal, endowed by the Creator with inalienable rights. You know, Britain didn't pretend that it believed in universal rights. None of these, Spain, Portugal, go down the list. So to combination of being founded in slavery and not simply being able to just purge that, I think, you know, people often compare United States to Germany following the Holocaust and how Germany purged, you know, all remnants of Nazism. If we were to do that in the United States, if we were to try to purge all remnants of slavery, we would have to get rid of George Washington monuments, Thomas Jefferson, Madison, who was the father of the Constitution, half of the, you know, it's like it's impossible to do that.
Having said that, Germany also paid reparations.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But even, again, it's not because it was not, well, it took a long time for Germany to pay reparations too. Mm-hmm. Clearly not as long as the fight for Black Americans to get reparations for slavery. But on top of, like, we can't really purge this because to purge the monuments to enslavers means we have to purge our entire founding, which, you know, we clearly don't want to do. But also, there aren't really very many Jewish people left in Germany. You don't have to every day in the United States, every day we have to look at the people whom we did this to. There's no separation whatsoever. So for that reason, our response has been to downplay it, to marginalize it, to pretend that slavery wasn't that central to America, that it wasn't that big of a deal, and to really be apologists for the institution. I think that's what sets us apart from the other colonial powers.
Nicole, can I ask you about, I want to go back to the mid-70s. You know, it's like, you know, in Waterloo, you know, it's like your mother has a Czech and then a British side or background, your father is Black. Like, how was the family in terms of, was there, talk to me a little bit about your upbringing, your childhood in Iowa.
Yeah, so my parents met, my mother was from rural Iowa and she came to what would be my hometown to go to college. And my father used to go on campus. And that's how my parents met. And my mother's parents were not happy at all. They disowned my mother for a period of time and didn't speak to her, stopped paying for her college. My dad had to help her pay for college and didn't really re-embrace my mother until my older sister was born. So my older sister was the first grandchild and it was the birth of this first grandchild that brought my grandparents back into my mom's life. With that said, other family members like my mother's grandmother, you know, refused to disown her and just, you know, dealt with it as well as some other white relatives on that side. But once that happened, I grew up around my grandparents. My grandparents were great to me and my sisters, but they also were racist to Black people who weren't related to them. And I think, you know, what that has taught me is we have this belief that because someone has an intimate relationship with a Black person, that they can't be racist, when that's clearly not true. We are able to form close bonds with individuals and still have a larger and succumb to a larger worldview of anti-Blackness. But my childhood was, you know, a very working class childhood, lived on the Black side of town. My grandparents and my white side of the family lived about an hour away and we saw them frequently, but all my Black family lived in my hometown. And I grew up around, I mean, that's how I was raised. My dad, at a really young age, sat my sisters down and told us, your mom might be white, but you guys are Black and the world's going to see you as Black. And that's how you're going to go in the world. And so we did. So I've never been one of those mixed people who was conflicted or felt like they were living in between two worlds. I've never felt that way. And I don't even, I mean, clearly I'm biracial, but I identify as Black.
I have the same, I mean, I have the same, I have a white mother, white American mother, African American dad, and my father went about, you know, raising me the same way. Like, you're Black, you're going to grow up, you're going to be a Black person, the world is going to see you as Black. You just have to accept that and learn how to maneuver and navigate through the world as a Black body, basically. I grew up in Sweden, you know, and going to an all-white school and everything, I definitely was in between worlds. I was trying to, you know, use what my dad was telling me, but in an all-white context. And it was a lot of difficult years and years of kind of identity crises, basically.
Yeah, I could see that. And it's different, you know, in the context of a country like Sweden versus the context of a country like the United States. I mean, United States, you can be in a white environment, but race and Blackness is everywhere, right? Mm. So I think that, I don't know, I realized pretty young, you know, my dad told me that, and there's the intellectual part of that conversation, but also that with my white family, I was always half Black. So I wasn't ever... You know, like I was related to them, but with my Black family, I was Black. Like there wasn't like, she's half Black, she's half white. Like I was Black. And I just was like, I'm not going to spend my life trying to straddle a line. And particularly when we know in America, to be Black American is to be mixed anyway, right? Like Frederick Douglass was half white. The average Black person, when you test them genetically, a quarter of our ancestry goes to Europe. So that is the Black experience. And I appreciated my dad kind of setting us down and telling us that, but life was also teaching me that at the same time. And I think that mixed people who have a hard time, you know, fitting in or feeling like they don't belong anywhere are not mixed people who are raised around Black people. That's how I feel. I feel like when you are mixed and raised around Black people, you don't have a family. I live in the hood.
I have another question around, you know, Portland. You went out to go to work in Portland, and Portland is a city that Jason and I talked about here on this moment. When you see what's happening and you work in the city, so clearly you have love for that city. Can you give us your
beat and your thoughts on what's happening?
Wait, did you say I have love for that city?
No, but I mean, when you've lived in a place.
I was never so happy to get out of a city in my life.
That was the wrong question. I meant you lived there, so you've had an experience there. So
I do. You know, I moved to Portland because they at that time it was a newspaper where if you wanted to become a narrative journalist, they taught narrative journalism, and so I went there for career advancement. But never, you know, I told myself after growing up in Iowa that I would never live in a city that white again. And then, you know, somehow ended up in Portland. So Portland, what's happening in Portland right now is like not surprising to me because, you know, there are all these concerns that white people have kind of taken over the movement there, that it is no longer about Black people really anymore. And that's like so not surprising to me. People who have watched Portlandia, like that's real life. That's how it is. This is a place that believes it's progressive, and it's so progressive because it is the whitest major city in the country. It is whiter than Salt Lake City, which seems impossible. So it's easy to be progressive when you have never really had to deal with Black people. In the history of Oregon, when Oregon entered statehood, Black people were barred in the state constitution of Oregon from moving into the state. And I think it might be the only state in the country where Black people were prohibited by the Constitution from actually moving into the state. Many of the original settlers of Oregon were former Confederates. So it has this very kind of progressive, but it's progressive when it comes to like trees and gay rights and women's rights. But when it comes to race, That was probably one of the most disenfranchised Black populations that I've ever lived in. And so to see like them take a movement that was ostensibly supposed to be about Black lives and then turns into whatever the hell it turned into now, I'm not surprised.
Hearing you speak about Portland, it makes me feel like you're describing Sweden in a way. Because
Sweden, very similar.
Yeah, and of course, you're welcome to come to Sweden at any time. We'd love to have you. But I mean, Sweden was so demographically homogenous for so many years. And I think that's what led them to believe that they were a post-racial kind of utopian society. But now that it is much more multiracial and we basically are... Demography is a map of the past, you know, the wars that have happened over the past three decades, you know, with people coming from the Horn of Africa, from the Middle East, obviously, from Afghanistan, and then the steady trickle of migrants from West and Central Africa. Now, all of a sudden, or for the past 10 years, Sweden has had to grapple with the fact that it is, in fact, a society that's deeply racist in so many ways. And it's interesting, as you see, in a city that's all white or a country that's all white, then of course you have no problems with racism because your bias has never come into play, you know?
Right. I mean, this is much the way that the North in America got this reputation of being, you know, the opposite of the South, not racist. But that's only because, you know, until the turn of the 20th century, no Black people really lived in the North. The populations were very small. And then as soon as you saw millions of Black Southerners migrating to the North, the exact same type of violence, segregation that you saw in the South happened in the North. And so Portland epitomizes that to me. It's easy to say that you are racially progressive when you don't have to deal with Black people. And then when Black people started moving to Portland after World War II, they were segregated in North and Northeast Portland. You can go to Portland right now and there are all Black elementary schools and all Black high schools in a city that is 6% Black. Like, that shouldn't even be possible, but it is. And what they consider like the hood schools would be like a fabulous school in Brooklyn, trust me.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Finding your perfect home was hard. But thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, I think it's so beautiful with 1619 because it sets a new level of journalism, right? That people can connect in all over the world and orally, these voices, these people, you humanize an experience that it just changed information, how information and history can flow. How long did you work on it to, because it's obviously a masterpiece. So you must have worked on it for a very long time.
Obviously, no plan. thank you. Thank
Most
you for
definitely.
That. Yeah. You know, there's like, so how long did I actually like work on it would be about 9 months from the time I pitched it to the time I published, which is kind of insane considering what we did. And those were some crazy months. But I've been in some ways working on it for like 25 years. I came across the date 1619 as a high school student and have been obsessed with the erasure of that date. And I came across it accidentally. I didn't come across it in my high school curriculum, but I took a one semester Black Studies elective and became so angry that there was all this history no one ever thought we should know that when the class ended, I kept going back to the teacher and asking him to give me more books. And I would read a book and then ask for another. And one of the books that he put in my hand was a book called Before the Mayflower by Lerone Bennett. And the title speaks to the fact that, you know, the Mayflower lands in 1620. Every American child learns about the Mayflower, but the White Lion came in 1619 and none of us learned about that. So even as like a 16 or 17 year old, I understood the power of that erasure and that was intentional. So I've been thinking literally since I was in high school about that date and how that date kind of served as a metaphor for the way we have not wanted to deal with the institution of slavery. And so much of my work through the last decade has been about really trying to connect the present to these intentional historical decisions that were made. And I used to joke, we had this ongoing joke amongst my editors that one day I was going to get us back to slavery because usually I'm always starting in like 1950 or 1910 and building this case, yeah. But I hadn't been able to get back to slavery. And the 1619, you know, as the date was approaching the anniversary year, I just knew that like so much of the history of slavery and the history of Black Americans, this 400th anniversary was going to pass with no acknowledgement in American society, and that most Americans didn't know the date 1619. They weren't going to know the date 1619, and I was going to do something about it. So the short is, you know, 9 or 10 months, but the long is I've been thinking about this and the arguments. Like the basic premise, of course, of the project is almost nothing about modern American society has been left untouched by slavery. I've been making that argument for a long time. I always tell people, just name something and I can trace it back to slavery. So,
and you have engraved that year now in, I'd say, the consciousness of a lot of not only Americans, but people all around the world, thanks to your work.
Thank you. That's been amazing to see that. That was my goal, and it actually seemed like a very, I don't want to say arrogant, but, you know, kind of ridiculous goal to say, I want to create this project so that every American knows the date 1619. And then to actually see, like, the way that is that date is constantly evoked now. Mm-hmm. And that even the president, you know, I don't believe that the president has read the 1619 Project. And, you know, I don't think it's leading his followers to say, let me read the 1619 Project. But his followers also now know the year 1619.
Exactly.
So, it's all good.
Even those that don't agree.
And now, speaking to what you were saying about that erasure, you know, my dad also just sent me this Sean King piece talking about the third verse of the Star Spangled Banner. And I mean, I'm just finding out about this now, and I'm 45 years old. Mm. It's like, how could anyone ever have stood for that? I mean, had we known, right?
So yeah, that erasure
Francis
is so
Scott
deep.
He was an enslaver. He was an enslaver, right? So again, it's like we keep wanting to pretend that slavery was not the true United States, but it was. And even in the original Declaration, Thomas Jefferson talks about slavery, and he talks about the same thing that Francis Scott Key is talking about in the Star-Spangled Banner, which is that Britain is stoking insurrection amongst those enslaved, and that this is one of the crimes that the King of England is committing against the colonists, is he is causing the enslaved to rebel against them. So that doesn't end up getting in the original or in the Declaration because they couldn't get enough Southern colonists to sign it with that passage about slavery, because they rightly thought if they put that in there and said slavery was wrong and the King of England forced it upon us, that they would have to abolish slavery, which, you know, obviously they weren't trying to do. But it's like understanding, when you see all of that, then it's like the red pill in the Matrix. Like suddenly everything starts to make sense. And you understand that this, again, that this erasure has served a purpose. And we have borne the brunt of that erasure.
The other year, and I was thinking about it today, I hope she does it before, but you know, the way you trace back everything to American slavery, I trace it back to Prince. So after Purple Rain, I trace it back to Prince. So after Purple Rain, there was a couple of albums, and then came Sign of the Times. So the other big year is 2042. So when you what do we need to know about 2042? And will you document it? Will you tell us about 2042? Or because obviously for a lot of people, it's a big fear about that year, about that time.
Are you talking about when the demographic shifted to the United States?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that we are putting way too much emphasis on the idea that once white people are no longer the majority, that they will somehow lose power. There's nothing about the study of American society that leads us to believe that. White people were the minority in the South in many parts of the South, for much of the history of this country, including Mississippi, which was the most repressive fascist state in the United States. So I, and the inverse of that is, even in 2042, white people will not be the minority, but they will be the largest in the plurality. And that assumes that every person who is not white will come together in some cohesive mass and work together. We know that that's not true. We know that. Anti-Blackness is rife amongst other non-white groups. We have not seen a cohesiveness. I actually think that if conservatives get smart, they will do to a significant percentage of Latinos what white people have done to Italians, to the Greek. They will become white. So when people say our demographics are destiny, what we're seeing right now, President Obama won with a minority of the white vote. And what was that followed by? Massive introduction of voter suppression laws, of tactics to suppress the Black and Latino vote in order to hold on to power. In this country, we haven't had a Republican who won the presidency by popular vote in, I think, something like 30 years. Yet we've had Republican presidents because they win with the Electoral College, which actually is not Democratic. So I think we'll just see more repression and more efforts to hold on to power. Or look at New York City. New York City is a minority white city, but who controls the finance, right? Who controls the levers of power in the city? And where does the poverty and disenfranchisement land? So when people say that, it doesn't show to me a complexity of understanding the way that race actually works in this country.
It's also leaving out the colonial subjugation of the continent of Africa. I mean, we're white minorities in South Africa, Zimbabwe, Nigeria.
South Africa is probably like the most analogous to the United States, especially since some of them studied our system of apartheid to figure out how to do it there. I think we want to somehow believe that, but what we're seeing right now with white militia coming out to these rallies, like this effort to stoke a race war, is about consolidating and holding power as our country's demographics change.
Having said all that, I wonder, you know, do you see in your work, I mean, you also talk about that the needle has moved, you know,
that things have gotten better. I'm not a slave.
That's true.
No. There you go. And since your dad's day, things have actually gotten better, albeit slowly. But do you see a path forward? Is there a path for not only the United States, but the world to move into a kind of a post-racial America? Or is that just a utopian pipe dream?
I mean, yes, progress is, you would be silly not to acknowledge the progress that has been made, and particularly for a small group of Black people who have been able to go into elite institutions and get a middle-class existence. But I have two things to say to that. One, I just did a project called 1619 that shows that people of African descent have been here for 400 years. So the time for marking progress is over. We should be equal. We should be treated as full and equal citizens in a land we have been in for 400 years and a land we have been in longer than almost any other group. So when people want us to constantly pay attention to progress, to me, I find that insulting because it is saying that we still have to wait for equality and we cannot expect full equality right now. The other thing is when you look at probably the most important indicator of well-being, which is wealth, Black wealth has been unchanged for 70 years. The Black-white wealth gap, unchanged for 70 years, which predates the civil rights, well, falls in the middle of the civil rights movement. So overall, we've seen progress with the law and the end of legal discrimination, but not progress in the area that Dr. King was focusing on before he was assassinated, which is understanding that having the legal right to access certain spaces is useless if you can't afford to access those spaces. And that from the beginning, slavery was a system of economic exploitation. Jim Crow was a system of economic exploitation. It wasn't just about Black people not liking white people. It was about creating racism to justify the economic exploitation of Black people. And to this day, a black family with children has 1 cent on the dollar of wealth for white Americans. And that has remained unchanged. So we need to be very careful with these conversations about progress. And I don't feel like Black people are doing this, but when people who aren't Black say that, they're asking us to be grateful that we don't live in Jim Crow anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I need to be grateful for that in a country that our people have been in for centuries. And there's a difference between can we get there and will we get there? Can we get there? Absolutely. All of this was created. All of it can be uncreated. Will we get there? I don't think so. There's nothing, studying history can tend to make one, I would say realistic. Some people would say pessimistic. There's nothing about our history that makes me believe that we will get there.
No, I want to turn a little bit to the election because I love you have your vote sign on. And, with Kamala Harris, she shows the world now another side of Blackness. So you can be both Asian American and Black African American, right? So this, our experience is layered. It's complex. It's beautiful. And Blackness has so many different wings to it. What's your hopes and what's your biggest fear of this election coming up?
My biggest fear is that we get another 4 years of a white nationalist in the office, or that the election is so unsettled that, he's already been kind of laying the groundwork that he might contest or he might not leave. So that's my fear. And this isn't about, political party affiliation. We cannot afford in this country another 4 years of this in terms of national cohesiveness, which we've never had, but the degree to which he is willing to openly exacerbate racial divisions and in many ways call for violence. Clearly the pandemic response, the eroding of democracy, the authoritarian tendencies, the attacks on the press. I just don't think, America will not be the same for a very, very long time if he's elected again. So that's my biggest fear.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you also, Nicole, I mean, just basically, how is it being an investigative reporter in the United States today and also working for, I mean, your workplace is frequently called out by the president and frequently kind of bashed by him, you know, openly. How is it doing your work today?
Well, you know, so I don't cover politics, which until recently, until Trump started becoming obsessed with the 1619 Project, really buffered me from a lot of that. But for the New York Times, it's been good. Like, we have the most subscribers that we've ever had in the history of the paper. And I think what has happened is people clearly understand the necessity of journalism and accountability and investigative journalism and are willing to pay for it, where you know, for years, because of Facebook and Google, people just felt they should be able to get news for free as if it doesn't cost money to produce good reporting. But I think for us, I mean, clearly there's a larger problem with the erosion of trust in the media, the erosion of understanding that there are actually a set of facts. Everything is not relative. I think that's been very harmful in general. And that this president has exploited that and exacerbated that. And, in ways that I am very fearful we won't come back from. But for the New York Times as an institution, I think it has really shown the necessity of what we do.
My last question to you is, Black Lives Matters. There's two doors. If Trump wins, the marches and the everything will continue. If Biden wins, how does Black Lives Matters movement look like in a Harris-Biden win?
Yeah, I don't know. I try to never predict the future because you're almost always going to end up looking foolish. But I think a lot about when Trump won and the Women's March occurred. And I kept seeing these signs that white women were holding. And it said, if Hillary had won, we'd be at brunch right now. And I was like, that sums up the entire problem. Is you felt that Trump is the biggest problem in this country, and you are willing to ignore. You're not going to be marching for the people who have been struggling and afraid before Trump. You're only here because it is in your own personal interest right now. And then you will abandon this multiracial coalition that showed up at that march as soon as someone else is in office. And that is my fear. Is how do you, you know, so many people join this movement because of who the president is. I mean, this is the same reason I think people, in some ways, the response to the 1619 Project was so big. If I had done this project, if the anniversary had happened to land under Obama, you would have heard a lot of people saying, "Why? There's a black man in the White House. Why are you bringing this up? We're post-racial. Mm-hmm. We've moved on." Trump clearly defies that notion. So I'm worried about, will we be able to keep the pressure applied to actually get the type of transformative change that this moment requires if Biden wins? At the same time, we have to have someone competent in the White House. And it's order of needs. People are dying right now. So we have to have something better than that. But if you study the civil rights movement, you know that the civil rights movement begins at the end of World War I and doesn't bear its full fruit until the 1960s. It's decades. So the expectation that this movement will overnight produce those results, it just is not an understanding of social movements in this country. You have to keep up the pressure. The fact that they've been able to move Black Lives Matter from being considered fringe to within a decade, less than a decade. I mean, even the NFL somehow thinks that they paint end racism in the end zone. You know, the same NFL, though, that still won't bring Colin Kaepernick back in. You can see the movement building, but I just fear that once again, it won't be long before Black folks are mostly fighting this alone.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, on behalf of, you know, Black and brown bodies all over the world and in the United States, thank you for the work you're doing. And thank you for coming on this moment. And just, it's such a privilege just to hear you speak and to just to listen to you is just inspiring and wonderful.
Thank you for having me on. Mark, I hope to meet you one day, you know, when real life was happening, Jenny's Supper Club. I only get to Harlem like 3 times a year because, you know, that's like going out of town. But
Brooklyn to Harlem.
Well, when you live in Brooklyn, that's like going out of town. Yeah. So you have to plan it like a month in advance.
Yeah, but
I'm just such an admirer of what you've done in the community and how you always are an advocate of the community. So
Thank you. Hopefully, next time you come to America, stay controversial.
It's the right side of you're on the right side of history.
Look at that and tweet this shit out. I didn't even.
Yeah, that's why I was like, yeah, I stopped on that word. I was like, what? She didn't. You know, it wasn't somebody who is well-meaning who wrote this. You know, but that's how Wikipedia works. Yeah.
Anyway, I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much. All right. Bye bye.
This moment is produced by Mohammed El Abed. It's an Acast recording and can be heard on all platforms. So stay tuned. More depth coming your way soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.